So I wondered about the parameters. We have this thing that we read every morning on how issues and discussions are. The thing that was shocking was the language. When the Rambam suggested that this whole Abraham and the angels could have been a nevuah, the Rambam took off on him and said to him, not only wasn't that way, but he should have never said anything. What are the parameters? It's pretty serious when somebody calls another Tana a liar.
I'm not familiar with this, by the way.
It was Rabbi Hanina. It's repeated in the Chumash about this discussion between two Tanas. You never seen any language like that?
I don't remember seeing that. Let's put it into perspective. I think if someone walks into a Beis HaMedrash, walk into Mir, Lakewood, almost any Beis HaMedrash where there's serious learning going on, someone who's not conversant with the way people learn Gemara, they would see pairs of people, sometimes groups of people, shouting at each other. And shouting at each other things like, you don't know what you're talking about. And this is a mistake from word go. You missed the point entirely. Or they would say that's krum, which is like your thinking is corrupted. When Rabarin used to say shiurim, so his shiurim were like, they were spectacular shiurim. Rabarin Kudler. He was a genius, and his shiurim were brilliant discourses, both in terms of charifus and in terms of bekius. I mean, he would bring stuff together, he would tie things together. They were awesome. And it was a challenge to keep pace with him, because he really took you on a journey, which was like, how dill it was like going on a big roller coaster in Six Flags. You traveled up and down. I mean, there were times there were times that was dazzling and exciting, times that you just felt like you didn't know where he was and you were groping to stay with him. But he had this extraordinary command of the entire gamut of the Talmudic literature. So if you asked him, if you challenged him in the middle of a shiur, and of course he had this incredible clarity. So if you asked him something, especially if you thought that he was making a mistake, and you said to him, how could this be? And you were taking your life in your hands. He would sometimes take off on people who asked him questions. You'd say to him, I mean, this would be like there's the full pack mismanagement. You're an idiot. You absolutely don't have a clue what's going on here. Top Talmidim. He once said to carry him out of here. He's drunk. I mean, literally. And he said things like that. People would go to the Ragichova. The Ragichova had a mind so that people compared to the Vilna Goyim. Or to Rishonim. I mean, he had this. He was a genius. So one of the classic stories they say is that there was somebody who was considering a young Talmud Chacham as a chassan for his daughter. And he had a reputation as being a very special young Talmud Chacham. So he took him in to the Ragichova, that the Ragichova should talk to him in learning and determine whether he really was a Talmud Chacham. So he takes this young man in, the young man is talking to him, and the Ragichova says to him, you are Moritz, you ignoramus. And he like lambasts him. He must have called him a Moritz like 10 times. So after he listening to what the Ragichova, how he decimated him, and I'm Moritz. So he didn't pursue the Shidduch anymore. About a week later, comes into Lagacho, and Lagacho says to him, so did you do the shidduch with that young man? So he says to him, Rebbe, I heard you talking to him and learning, and you called Anamoritz 10 times. So he said to him, what's wrong with you? He says, do you know what it means to be an Amoritz by me? The Chagich was an Amoritz, was a big Talmud Chacham. The thing that we need to recognize over here is that there is nothing in the lives of these people about which they were so passionate as the study of Torah or the truth of Torah, or to carry it a step higher, there's nothing in their lives that's more precious than clarifying what the Ratzon, what the will of Hashem is. And in their passion to clarify these truths, the kinds of things that explode out of that earnestness and out of that eagerness and out of that passion are statements which might, to someone who wasn't familiar with the process, would be taken at face value, and one would say, well, he said he's an idiot, or he said that he's an ignoramus, or they said that he doesn't have a clue what's going on, or they said he's drunk. And the problem with taking those statements at face value is that for the uninitiated observer is that he doesn't understand the context. And that the context is a context of A, the deepest possible passion and concern to elucidate what the clarity and the truths of these situations are. And number two, that these people do in fact respect each other a great deal. And there's an understanding between them that this concern allows them the liberty of expressing how deeply they're invested in this thing by saying such things to each other. It's like, you're way out in left field, you don't know what's going on, you never knew what was going on, this is the most stupid thing I've ever heard, whatever. I mean, all these statements. But there's an understanding between them that this stuff is of such utmost seriousness that in pursuit of the clarity, that exaggeration is okay.
What's going on?
Right. I mean, there's a context over here, and it's contextually, the Ramban would be critical of the Rambam, and is sometimes critical of the Ibn Ezra, and the Ibn Ezra is sometimes critical about people in ways that are entertaining, as they are sharp. And the people who can say sometimes some of the serious, can shout at you some of those serious things. I mean, they walk out arm in arm. They care about each other. They respect each other. And there were instances in which people purposely would say or cast aspersions on someone else and an agenda that people weren't familiar with. There was my great-grandfather, the first Baba Vagov, was a person who had a tremendous amount of respect and esteem throughout Galmitzia. He had an uncle, the Golotzerov. The Golotzerov was known to be very, very caustic, very, very sharp, and who just kept on an onslaught of criticism and mockery of him. And my great-grandfather did not take it terribly seriously, despite the fact that he said some terrible things. And people were entertained by the criticisms and his sharp denunciations. One of my grandmother, I'm trying to think who it was, very bothered by the fact that here was this uncle that really causing a lot of pain to his nephew, to Moldov, and made a special trip to implore him to stop. So he said to her, I'll stop. But we will regret it. So he stopped. And my grandfather passed away several months after that cessation of... And he was a young man. He was 58. So somebody said to him, and he said he was such a sensational person. He said that I had felt that he would be subject to an ayin hara. So he said, so I tried to make sure that nobody would give him an ayin hara. So there are sometimes our agendas that we're not familiar with that go on in these. There was a Bel Mikubo somewhere around, I don't think he was amongst the Talmidim of the Ari, but he was a Mikubo, Lameya ben Gabai. He wrote a sefer called Avedas HaKadosh. In the sefer Avedas HaKadosh, he takes on all the Rishonim. The comments of the Rishonim about what took place with Avraham Avinu, like for example, his description of the Rambam's concept of the fact that this never happened, but it was a prophecy, it was a vision, and all of this took place in a vision. What took place at Har Sinai? What took place with Moshe Rabbeinu with the burning bush? All these kinds of things. So it doesn't matter whether it's the Rambam or the Barbanel, any of the kind of the rationalists who approached Torah and tried to, from the comments of our sages and the comments in Midrashim, to give some sort of perspective on what was transpiring. So they were working with the Kabbalah that they had, which was a Kabbalah of Nigla. The commentary on Torah from a surface level. The Meir ben Gabai was a Bal Mikubo and had a Kabbalah, Ish Mipish from Moshe Rabbeinu, as most Kabbalim and Kabbalim. And the information that Balim and Kabbalim had was not widely disseminated until the time of the Ari, and after the Ari until the time of the Baal Shem Tov, when it became really kind of much more accessible to the general population. So they argued their positions from premises that they felt were either compelling from the way the grammar of the pasuk read, or what one was obliged to make of it because of the comment of somebody in the Gemara or somebody in the Midrash. You know, you have this kind of comment. What do we do with it? On its face, it's not understandable unless we see it this way. So they were arguing from premises, explanations which they felt were either reasonable or compelling explanations from their perspective. And then somebody else came along and said, this is not at all compelling, and the premises that you're working from are not valid. So that's the kind of thing that you have when the Abravanel takes on the Rama, and so on. But when you have, for example, the Samir ben Gabai, or an Alshach, or Kisvi Ari, they're not working from logic, and they're not working from what's cogent from the standpoint of the grammar of the Pasuk or the Gemara. They're saying, this is a Kabbalah, here's what was transmitted to us, this is what happened. So Rami Ben Gabai does not deal with a great deal of awe or deference to the Rishonim, even though he was not a Rishon. I don't think he was he was right around the time when the transition took place between the Rishonim and Achronim, but he said, you know, this is just not valid because you're commenting on something that you don't know anything about. So, Betty shouldn't have spoken about it because, and the Ramban was a Bal Mikubo. The Ramban received the Kabbalah during the course of his life when he was still writing. And so when he takes on the Rambam, he's taking on the Rambam from the standpoint of the Kabbalah. Rameh ben Gabai, interesting, brings a letter which he says he personally saw that the Rambam writes after his works had been published and disseminated. He said somebody came to him and taught him the Chachmas HaKabbalah, and he writes that were it not for the fact that my Svarim have already been disseminated, I would have retracted some of the things that I had written. And this is not halacha. And halacha, the Rambam is pretty much the kind of the supreme authority. And none of these people quarrel on halacha. But when you're talking about commentary about what happened in the lives of the patriarchs, what happened when Eliezer went to find a wife for Yitzchak, the Mefarshim, the majority of the commentaries were working and are working from all of the available information that they had. So it may not be consistent with the Kabbalah, and the Balim and Kabbalah are going to say some very sharp things about those things. However, here is another very important thing. For the most part, even if their commentary does not tell you what transpired, but the ethical conclusions are valid. And that's really what's most important to us. So the Rambam may say, here's what happened. The Rambam will say to him, you know, nothing could be further from the truth. But the moral perspective or the spiritual inspiration remains as a guideline. So that's really kind of what ends up being most important to us, is not so much whether or not the Rambam was right or wrong about a sin, but what are the implications of what the Rambam said in terms of how we need to conduct our lives. In this week's Torah portion, for example, you have this thing with Rivka. So Rivka goes to the well, and she draws water for herself. And then Eliezer, who's already made this test, he's constructed this test, and he's told Hashem, you know, if this is the right one, then here's what, when I say this, she'll say this. So he runs over to her, and sure enough, she says, oh, sure, here's for you to drink, and I'll also give your camels to drink. And then he finishes the drinking, she pours the pitcher into the trough where the camels are going to drink, and she runs back and fills up the pitcher again and again. There, and I think we've probably addressed this before, but there are some wonderful commentaries about how he had constructed this test and why it was so important that she did what she did. He said to himself as follows. You know, sometimes you'll find somebody who's good-natured, but not too smart. Sometimes you'll find somebody who's smart and not particularly good-natured. And if I got to find a wife for Yitzchak, it's got to be somebody who is not only generous in disposition, but also somebody who is wise in being good. In order to truly be generous and kind in a way which is going to be meaningful, there needs to be wisdom attached to it. So he said to himself, I'm going to go ask her to give me a drink. So, and I'm purposely going to drink in such a way that I don't drink up all the water. Now, what is she going to do with the rest of the water? If she takes the water, she says to herself, I can't take the rest of this water home because I don't know this guy. And for all I know, he's sick. So maybe I'll be bringing home contaminated water. On the other hand, if I take the water for that conclusion and spill it out in front of him, then it's offensive. It's an insult to him. So I have no other choice other than to offer to give the camels to drink. Now, camels can drink. They can drink you out of house and home. They can drink a lot. When she volunteered to give the camels to drink, she was volunteering for a ton of work. Work that she was not anticipating, wasn't prepared to do. But it was the only thing she could do in order to be respectful to him and not unsafe and not endangering her family. So when he constructed this test, he said to himself, if she does this, this will tell me, A, that she's a generous disposition, but it also tells me that she's wise and that she's willing to pay the price for being good by doing all of this work. So Obviously, she made this calculation. She gave him the drink. He left it over. She looked into it, and she saw that there was water left. And she said, oh, I'm going to give you camels to drink, too. And that's when he knew that this was right. So now, there are other commentaries on this thing that give a different story. But that observation, the conclusion of that pshat, is valid whether or not it happened or not. So when you get different views of what transpired and why it happened, it doesn't change the fact that when this person was giving his explanation of why this was, it's a valid moral perspective for us. The Baditch Olov says that Ramban comments on the fact that it says as follows. This is chapter 24. So in post 16, it says, and the maiden was very beautiful, very fair to look upon, a virgin, and no man had known her, meaning sexually. And she went down to the well and filled her pitcher and came back up. Now, so just keep that in mind. Not the looking post 20. And she hurried, and she poured the pitcher into the trough, and ran again to the well to draw water. Vatishav l'chol gemalov, and she fetched the water. She drew for all those camels. So Ramban comments on the fact that in pasuk 16, it doesn't use the verb shoev. It says vatimale. She filled it up. And in verse 20, it speaks about drawing water. So the Ramban says that the Medrash says that one of the things that Eliezer saw was that when she went down to the water, that the water came up to greet her. That's why it says that she just filled it. Whereas in verse 20, the water didn't come up. She had to actually have to draw it up. So the Baditch Olov says that when she was filling it up for herself, the water came up to greet her. But when she was doing a mitzvah of Gemilas Chasadim, she was going to do a mitzvah, the water didn't come up to greet her, because if you're going to do a mitzvah, you got to work in it. You don't get any freebies on you. The mitzvah, you got a hug of it, you have to. He says that's the reason that when it comes to the filling up for all the camels and all the entire entourage, it says that she drew the water, but the water didn't come up to greet her, because since she was going to do a mitzvah, she was going to have to invest the Mesiras Nefesh in doing a mitzvah. So there's a lot of comments. So, and there are other comments on this, why the water came up to greet her then, didn't come up to greet her later on. The basic observation about the fact that when you come to do a mitzvah, that you don't get any freebies, you got to really... remains, that observation remains as a valid perspective on how Jews think and how we approach life. So many times you'll find that you have all these different opinions about something, and it doesn't change the fact that both opinions have something to offer you about what's right. All right, folks.
Thanks, Rob.